This week's sponsor is Neon's new film, The Life of Chuck. Based on Stephen King's iconic short story, The Life of Chuck is brought to the screen by friend of the show, Mike Flanagan, the writer-director of Dr. Sleep and Gerald's Game, among other things, and stars Tom Hiddleston, Mark Hamill, and Matthew Lillard. The Wrap calls The Life of Chuck Mike Flanagan's best film yet. Jason Gorber from Collider says it's the best Stephen King film ever made. And Eric Vespi from the King cast says, go see it or I'll sock you in the eye. For some reason, they wouldn't put that one on the poster, but I stand by what I said, and I mean it. The Life of Chuck opens in select theaters June 6th and everywhere June 13th. Fangoria has been at it for over 40 years, and it is better than ever. This magazine, it's not only gorgeous, it's highly collectible, and it's delivered right to your front door four times a year. Each issue is filled to the brim with articles exploring every nook and cranny of genre filmmaking, past, present, and future, with all the most exciting journalists, filmmakers, and horror know-it-alls to guide the way, including little old me from time to time. This high-quality writing will only ever appear within the physical pages of the magazine, never online, so if you want to join in on the fun, you're going to need to subscribe, and in order to do that, all you got to do is head on over to Fangoria.com and sign up, and if you use the code KINKCAST at checkout, you will save a ginormous 25% off of your subscription. That's Fangoria.com, code KINKCAST. Now on with the show.
Hi, my name is Stephen King.
He's gonna break!
Red rum! Red rum!
You guys wanna go see a dead body?
Well, sometimes that is better.
Welcome back to the KingCast here on the Fangoria Podcast Network. I'm Anthony Bresnikan.
And I'm Eric Vespi.
And we are your hosts. Eric, you know, I like to be prepared, so I typed up a little intro here, and whenever I write Fangoria, my software autocorrects it to Sangria.
Oh, Sangria. Mine, so Sangria. It autocorrects Fangoria to all caps for some reason. And does that on my computer and on my cell phone. I don't know if it's because they're connected and they're married, or if they pulled some strings over at autocorrect to be in all caps at Fangoria. I don't know.
But I'm thinking the Sangria Podcast Network would also, I wouldn't mind being on that. That'd be cool.
Yeah.
Like just be out on the patio, nice sunny Mediterranean day. Sangria with a, pour a glass of sangria. Yeah. Our guest today, maybe she would enjoy a glass of sangria. I'll let her answer that, is a master of horror in many senses. Tanana Reeve Dhu is a novelist and short story author whose books include The Good House, that's one of my favorites, and the collections Ghost Summer and The Wishing Pool. Her book, My Soul to Keep, was called, quote, an eerie epic, bears favorable comparison to Interview with a Vampire. I love this novel. And that quote comes from none other than Stephen King himself. Tanana Reeve is also a journalist. You can look up her interview with Anthony Hopkins and Jodie Foster, looking back at The Silence of the Lambs. That's on VanityFair.com, as well as her piece, Can We Live?, about growing up in a family led by the civil rights pioneers Patricia Stevens Dhu and John Dhu. She's also a screenwriter who, among many other projects, co-wrote the small town episode of the revamped Twilight Zone series, along with her husband, fellow author Stephen Barnes. They have a podcast and video series together called Life Writing. She is also a longtime educator specializing in the subject of Black horror. You may have seen the viral video of her getting Jordan Peele to surprise her UCLA class to discuss Get Out. That blew their minds. She's one of the experts in the documentary horror noir. And Tanana Reeve's most recent novel is The Reformatory, which is now new in paperback. It's a deeply personal ghost story inspired by elements of her own family history about a notorious segregated juvenile detention center in the 1950s. It's the heart of the Jim Crow South, and this story centers on a 12-year-old Black boy who discovers that the children who have suffered and died in the place where he is now being held have not all moved on. We have another quote here from Mr. Stephen King calling it a wonderful, spooky story. That's how he described it in an interview on PBS NewsHour, and he also wrote, "You're in for a treat. The Reformatory is one of those books you can't put down. Tanana Reeve Dhu hit it out of the park." Tananarive Due, welcome to the KingCast.
Wow, all the memories of the blurbs.
All the blurbs. Does it freeze you at all when you're writing your next thing, knowing that Stephen King is for sure going to read it? Like, do you have to sit there and go, you know, maybe that sentence shouldn't end the way it does. Maybe that paragraph needs to be broken up. I would be frozen in my tracks. Like, I've been lucky enough to email with Stephen King, and even that, like, I think I let a typo go in one, and I just wanted to lock myself in the closet for like a day when that happened.
Well, no pressure until just now when you brought that up.
Okay, I mean, good.
Actually, there is pressure. It wasn't specifically from King, except now that you mention it, that is an added element, because
you're
I think
welcome.
For a lot of us as horror writers, he is like Uncle Steve,
mm-hmm.
or even Papa Steve, frankly. I think it's more like Papa Steve.
Yeah.
But for a book like The Reformatory, which is my first novel in many years, you know, I published a couple short story collections while I was procrastinating. Mm-hmm. From working on The Reformatory, but it has both sold better and gotten the most critical acclaim of anything I've ever written. And I know that a lot of new readers are discovering me through The Reformatory. So I think that's the pressure is, oh, this will be my next novel, will be the first perhaps novel a lot of those new readers have read since The Reformatory by me. It's a pretty high standard to live up to. And yeah, sentence by sentence, I'm like, have I already used that word in this manuscript? And is there another way I can describe what it feels like to be afraid? Because that's the thing I even wonder about with someone like King, who's been writing about fear his whole career. How do you come up with new ways to say I'm scared, new body functions, new heart pounding? It's tough, actually.
Mm-hmm. Your book, The Reformatory, it has racked up a number of prizes in addition to very happy, nice sales for you. The Shirley Jackson Award for Best Novel, that's a good one to get. And the Bram Stoker Award for Best Novel, both in 2023. You've had a good run with it so far, but now it's in paperback. What do you find is your experience when a book has that second life? It's in a new format? Because when I was a kid... I read everything as paperbacks. I did not have the dough to spend on hardbacks. I could get it from the library, maybe, but at my library, there was likely to be only one copy of every book. And so if it was in demand, I might have to wait a long time to find it. But do you find there's a different audience for the trade paperback version of something like The Reformatory?
True story. This mm-hmm. is the first time in trade paperback for The Reformatory that I have ever seen a book of mine in an airport.
That's
sweet. Doesn't that feel good? I know like airport novel is sort of like a knock or something, but like I
know.
Think that would be a hugely flattering moment as a writer to see your book in a place like that.
It does not feel like a knock at all. And as a matter of fact, you know, people started sending me pictures from the road before I ever saw it.
Mm-hmm.
I would get these pictures, as we say, in the wild, from people at airports telling me they'd seen the book. And sure enough, on a recent trip back home, where my dad is living in Atlanta, I was at Ontario Airport in California. And sure enough, there it was on the bestseller list. You know, not super high up on the bestseller list, but on the list.
You made it.
I had to lean way down to take a picture next to it. But I was just like, oh my God.
That's the list is the list, man. If you're on the list, you're good.
So that has been different. I've never had this kind of commercial breakthrough success with a book before. And it is showing up in the paperback. I never saw the hardcover at an airport. So I absolutely know that new readers are discovering it. And one thing I noticed on book tour, because let me give you guys a history lesson. You know, I started publishing back in the 90s. And back in those days, it was the midst of a huge renaissance in Black literature, Black film. Mm-hmm. I mean, this was the era of Devil in a Blue Dress. Walter Mosley got his film adaptation finally. Eves Bayou, like an unknown director, Casey Lemons, gets to direct this very specific and precious story about Black womanhood in the South. So there were a lot of things happening back in the 90s, and that was when I came of age. But a lot of my readers, I would say 80% of my readers were Black women. And not mad at it. You know, there were all these independent Black bookstores, and the booksellers would hand sell the book So my first crowd of 100 people was at Marcus Spokes in Oakland, a sea of black women, you right? And I was like, oh, thank you, my sisters, for supporting me. Well, something has changed because even when I was on tour for the hardcover, there was this particularly one event in Atlanta that was very large, and it was split black and white readers, like black and black and white male and female readers, so enthusiastic, so loving the story. And I'm just like, wow, something has really changed since the 90s. And I think that thing that has really changed is that horror, with a lot of editors like John Joseph Adams, who started reprinting my stories, and he was also the editor of Jordan Peele's Out There Screaming, are exposing horror readers to marginalized horror, like Stephen Graham Jones, an indigenous author, is one of the top horror writers in the country right now, which would
Regular
have
guest on
been,
this show too, a friend of Eric's.
it would have been unheard of in the 90s. I'm just telling you, that was not a thing in the horror community. So I would say that whether it's queer horror, whether it's women in horror, black horror, indigenous horror, this is an era where horror readers in particular have been so accepting and embracing of difference. And I have a theory about it. I have a theory about it.
What's the theory?
I think it's because horror depends upon novelty for its power. And there's only a certain degree to which you can literally see the same thing over and over again before that novelty wears off. So if like my novel The Good House is a like it trope wise it looks like a haunted house novel. If you read it, you start to realize it's a demon possession novel, but the demon is from a different tradition than Roman Catholicism, right? And that I find that intriguing. When I was reading The Only Good Indians by Stephen Graham Jones, I was so absorbed by what I didn't know about those traditions and didn't know what to expect. And that just makes it scarier. So I think that's why horror is a great breeding ground for audiences that want novelty and freshness and something from different traditions. That's my theory.
Yeah, I think you're pretty right on. I also think horror's always been a home for, pardon the pun, the outsiders as well, right?
True.
And it's which makes it even funnier when you see the old guard, you know, the people that look like me that get really upset at the DEI of horror, that you the emails that poor Phil at Fango gets, you know, every week from the, you know, the gatekeepers essentially of this is what my fandom should be. It should only be Terrifier and anything else is just trying to shove politics down my throat kind of stuff. And it's just like it's like my dude, like horror's been this way for forever. You know, that's it's always been about pushing societal norms and pushing buttons and attracting the weirdos and the or and or the marginalized, you know, and it's like, you know, that's what horror's always been, and I'm sorry if you don't recognize it. It's kind of like it reminds me of the people that watch Star Wars and don't understand, you know, don't understand the politics at play there. And you know, they can be rooting against the Empire in one moment, then you know, out supporting it in real life the next, you know.
Exactly.
So
That make it make sense.
yeah, so it's but yeah, no, it's I think your theory is exactly in line with that, in that, you know, I think genre in particular has always been, you know, a home for those that don't feel represented. So, yeah. Now,
And
oh, go ahead.
I was just going to add really quickly that also for the reformatory specifically, as I was researching it, because it's set in 1950, it's set during the Jim Crow era, and these kids are left alone because their father has been accused of a crime he didn't commit, right? So I realized while I was writing it that it was kind of a funhouse mirror version of, oh my gosh, To Kill a Mockingbird, right? To Kill a, and I mean, not, I'm not trying to compare them, but just in the sense that To Kill a Mockingbird is the story of a man and a family facing an unfair accusation from the outside in, right? So there were elements of the reformatory just because of that backstory. That's not what the whole plot hinges on, but because of that backstory of their father having been removed from their lives, I'm kind of retelling that story from the inside out. And I think for a lot of people who grew up reading To Kill a Mockingbird, Maybe they don't read horror that often or whatever. It feels familiar. It feels like, this is a terrain I know, and it's a part of history I heard about a little bit in school, but I've added some ghosts to it, so it's a little bit different.
I mean,
Even though
this is.
that one has a character named Boo in it, there's a lack of ghosts in To Kill a
Blue,
Mockingbird.
blue. I should have named him Boo, actually, but his name is actually Blue.
What's Boo Radley's actual name? It's not
Oh, you
actually
mean
Boo,
To
right?
Kill a Mockingbird? I'm
Oh
sorry.
yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, it's fine.
Yeah.
What is his does he what's his like birth name?
Now that I.
Bartholomew.
Oh,
Bartholomew? Is that
no,
right?
I don't know.
I don't
I
know.
was going to say, you're exactly the kind of reader I'm talking about. You know the book inside and out.
That is a kind of
I
scary
know.
part of that book, though, is Boo Radley, you know? Like,
Right.
also the first screen role for Robert Duvall, I
Yep,
believe, right?
that's true.
He played Boo
He
in
did.
that movie. This is such a personal story for you, too, Tananarive. The main character, this 12-year-old boy, is named after an uncle, a great uncle or uncle of
Great
yours?
uncle.
Great uncle, who really did go into a place like this. And I don't think it's the name of the reformatory is fictional in your book, right? But there's
Yes.
the real reformatory that's infamous. I think it was inspiration for a lot of storytelling, but also a lot of very crushing journalism over the years, because there are boys who would go into this place and not come out, and nobody seemed to be taking account of what became of them or why. They were almost just sort of written off, right? These are forgotten people, forgotten boys that the society just said, well, they were troublemakers anyway, right? Or how would you describe the way this place was able to operate for so long with sort of impunity?
Very well put, Anthony. I mean, I compare it to an operation, a corporation that's considered too big to fail. And when I say corporation, I mean that literally, because the Dozier School for Boys in Marianna, Florida, which is what I based the reformatory on, was a huge employer in this town. And it provided the corn for this town and the printing press for the town. And the boys would march in the Christmas parade and be a championship football team. And one of the memoirs, and I can't remember who wrote it, he said that he was warned not to be too much of a football star. They wouldn't let him out till he was 21, because they could hold you until you were 21. You had kids as young as 5 and as old as 21. The place was beset by complaints, like from its inception. It opened at about the turn of the century back in 1900, around then, and letters and complaints immediately should have been shut down from jump. They were shackling boys. I mean, some of the boys were just there because they were orphans. Okay, so we're not talking about like super hardened criminals here. These were, as we said, the marginalized, many of them poor, obviously, whether they were black or white, not having the resources to stand up. And it was so horrific. And I just saw this in the movie The Nickel Boys, which is Colson Whitehead's novel set at the same fictionalized reformatory, where if you were running away, they would just shoot at you. Okay, your children running away. And I saw former guards writing about this on Facebook of all places. And it's just that, it was just that out of control. So of course it had its own cemetery called Boot Hill. And that was my discovery of this story. My great uncle was buried at Boot Hill. And when I say buried, I don't mean that they had crosses or any kind of way to show that this was where they had been laid to rest. Some Boy Scout troops put up crosses, but these were unmarked graves, often dug by other children. In one memoir, a survivor talked about helping to dig his brother's grave.
Oh my God.
So, and the parents would get a letter. By the way, your child is dead. And I saw in a documentary about this place that one family demanded to have the remains sent back to them. And what they got was a casket full of wood scraps instead of a body. It's just the kind of stuff that really speaks to horror, even before you add ghosts to it. And in fact, it was only because I added the ghost that I could even get through writing it. I barely got through it. I heard about the place in 2013, heard some interviews with survivors, decided I definitely needed to write about this place. I wrote my novel to give my great uncle a better ending. That was my whole motivation, was to give him a different story and a better ending without being too spoilery about it. But to wade through this research and talk to these survivors, I mean, it was even while I was on book tour, I was meeting survivors. One, like a white man, maybe in his 40s, who had been there in the 90s, who was shaking when he came to talk to me. And that same morning, I had spoken to an 80-something-year-old man who was there in 1950, who was so traumatized that the first words out of his mouth were, "It still hurts." So this was multi-generational trauma across many families. And in my own family, nobody knew who Robert Stevens was. I never heard about him before I heard from the state of Florida and the researchers, Aaron Kimmerly, who was running the investigation and exhumations. But it was such a trauma that no one even talked about it.
Talk with us about your ghosts, because I think there's something so inherently sad about that part of the book. What I would say is, like, quote unquote, like the fun part of the book is the spirits, because that's the fantastical part. The rest of it is like you get this sinking feeling like this sounds real. And of course, if you compare it to the real research you did, obviously a lot of it was real. And real anytime there's a school that has a cemetery associated with it, that's a bad sign.
That's a
Something,
very bad sign.
yeah.
Something
But
has gone awry.
the ghost, I thought, as Robert is headed to the reformatory, he keeps thinking somebody, the judge or the social worker, there's like a Jewish social worker that he thinks like might help him. Everybody, he keeps waiting for someone to help him, and I thought these ghosts are doing the same, right? They're waiting for something, but they're never getting out. Not only are they being held longer than they should, as you mentioned, these boys could they're kept there whether they deserve to be or not, if they're useful to the reformatory and the powers that run it. They can extend their stay. In some ways, that called to mind some elements of the Shawshank Redemption, right? Is that they do that because he's a good accountant. Let's keep him around. And if there's evidence that he's innocent, let's ignore that. And there's something about compounding the injustice there. But the ghosts, tell us about what the ghosts want in your story, how aware they are, how they operate, what your internal logic was as you crafted this story for them.
In a longer version of the reformatory, I would have loved to have more like chapters from the point of view of the Haints, as I call them, because they have their own culture and society that we see glimpses of from the point of view of Robert, who has a gift for seeing them. And because Robert has a gift for seeing them, they gravitate to him. It's like, oh, someone can see us. And one of the secrets to calling a haint, I mean, it's not foolproof, as Robert learns in the story, but if you call them by their full name, it's supposed to be irresistible because they haven't heard it for so long. And that's what I was thinking about in terms of my real life relative, Robert Stevens. My mother did not know she had an uncle named Robert Stevens. He had a namesake who did not know for whom he was named. No one was calling his name. So at the reformatory, Robert learns if you call a ghost by their real name, they have to come because they crave that connection, really acknowledgement. Anyone who reads ghost stories knows that usually what ghosts want is just someone to know that they existed and how they died. That's why they're not at rest. And at this place, there's this whole community of young people who died in such unjust ways that they are kind of trapped and stuck here looking for a form of redemption, looking for maybe even payback, let's say. And the warden is so diabolical, and he's been working there for decades. So not only is he responsible for the deaths of some of these young men, but he basically enlists Robert to be a haint catcher so he can capture their spirits and keep them from haunting him, right? Like knocking over the flower bags and little nuisance hauntings that he thinks make him look bad, right? So yeah, that's kind of what Robert is stuck doing. He's having his loyalties tested because yeah, the Haints are scary to him at first, but he also has a unique capacity to communicate with them to see beyond what's scary. And that's kind of the hat trick with the reader and Robert. He thinks the scariest part of the reformatory will be, oh my gosh, I heard it's haunted. But no, that's the least of his problems, actually.
They're not there to harm him so much as the living beings that are in charge and supervising things.
But also, a friendship with a haint is fraught with peril and misunderstanding as well. They don't have the same sort of they're not that clinging to life, first of all. That's the first thing. They don't have the same fear of mortality that we do. So if you're hanging out with the haint, you might end up in some dangerous business. That's all I'm saying.
I know it was tough to write. It took you a good decade, right? Once from when you started to when you published.
Almost. It was about 7 years.
And you really had put your shoulder into it and commit. I saw you just posted something on Blue Sky about your schedule and how you committed to writing several pages a day at minimum this much, just to keep yourself going. Did it get easier as you? Is it like working out where you lift the weights in the first day or two? You're like, ah, oh, this sucks. I never want to do this again. And then you build up some muscle and some resistance to the thing that makes it hard. And did you find it moved faster as you went through, or was it easier to revisit?
I didn't realize how traumatized I was by writing the novel. Like the years were piling up, and I told myself it was because, oh, I'm working on my first TV script. I did my Twilight Zone script during that time, or oh, it's because of this or that, or my son. And I always had a reason I wasn't working on it. And then by the time I got to 2020, 2019, 2020, I realized it was emotional. It was an emotional aversion to being in 1950. To being at this facility with Robert. And I just had to do the wintry cabin thing. I think in the fall of 2019, I went to a cabin and I broke the story through the end. And by January, I had that page chart on my wall. And that made it easier because I didn't have the luxury of listening to the voices that were telling me, oh, well, why don't you work on this or why don't you work on that? Because it was an emotional version. I just had to face it. And I guess, honestly, I look to Robert for some of that strength. I love a child protagonist because they are so adaptable and they can use imagination in a way that's very different from an adult. So I basically had to cling to his sense of optimism and his sense of, oh, I can make a difference or I can take charge of my own fate despite my fear to get me over the finish line. That was a tough write.
You mentioned this notion of, like, you call the haints by their full name and they're compelled because they're being seen, they're being heard, they're being recognized. Did that strike you immediately as the sort of undercurrent of this novel, that by telling this story in this way, by layering in some supernatural elements, that you are essentially saying the names of these real boys who died there? Your main character is named after your uncle. He bears his name and maybe doesn't have the same outcome, but you also mentioned his body was not so much buried as it sounds, almost like disposed of. He's cast away, not marked, and this is a way of just sort of forgetting it. Do you feel like you've been able to call attention to the real life tragedy that took place at Dozier?
I really do. And that's actually the same question this young white man asked at my Atlanta signing before he came up to me, before he revealed that he was a Dozier survivor. His question was, did you write this book to tell the story of your great uncle or for all the boys who were at the Dozier school? And I answered right, thank goodness, because by the time I finished, certainly it did feel like it was for all the boys, for the and the broken older men, old men, some of whom didn't survive, that 7 year span when I was researching the book, who fought alcoholism, who had trouble in their relationships, were estranged from their children. I mean, the damage went on beyond their generation, as all childhood damage can. So absolutely, I felt like I was writing it for all of the boys, and I'll call it coincidentally because this fight was going on long before my book came out. But last year, the governor of Florida actually approved funds to pay reparations to survivors of the Dozier School, which you can only imagine how horrific it must have been for a red state and a very red governor, whose name I don't even want to mention, frankly, to sign that legislation. It must be irrefutable, beyond politics, beyond race, And I like to think I help bring some attention to it.
This story has, it's obvious catnip for somebody like Uncle Steve. You know, he's a social justice minded guy and he loves ghost stories too. Do you know how the book came across his radar? I know you two go back a ways and we can talk about your early connections on the stage with him.
It wasn't for me. It wasn't for me. I bet. I mean, if anything, maybe Joe Hill, because Joe Hill had come aboard almost from the beginning with a great blurb
Oh, cool.
and mentioned it in his newsletter. Even when I had him on my podcast, he wanted to talk about the reformatory. So Joe Hill was very, very responsive to the book. And I imagine maybe he gave his dad a nudge. But I was, he didn't, my editor, of course, had tried him for the deadline and hadn't heard back. So I gave up on that. I had gotten one blurb from Stephen King from My Soul to Keep back in the 90s, and that's like a peak moment. And I was like, you know what? If that's all I get, I'm happy with that. But I was literally doing an Instagram live when someone said in the chat, Stephen King is talking about your book on Twitter right now. This was back when I was still on Twitter. And I stayed on the Instagram live, but of course I went to another screen to see what was going on. I was like, and that was what the blurb was. That was his tweet about the story. And I was like, so yeah, another great peak moment.
And then he talked about it a bunch of different places because I saw it on PBS,
PBS
where
too.
he's talking about the book and as somebody who's friendly with him and obviously likes his stuff. You've talked about him being an influence on you and you were a young reader, like a lot of us were. Yeah, it must feel pretty good, right?
It's indescribable. He really was such a powerful force for me as a young reader and young writer, my North Star in many ways in terms of how to create characters in horror, which was what strikes me the most, perhaps, but besides his scares, it's but the scares don't work without the characters. So for me, it's the characters first and foremost. And yeah, and in terms of my first time, I have to tell this really quickly. And you may obviously want to go into this in more detail, but I had met Stephen King originally at the Miami Book Fair when I was still a reporter for the Miami Herald, and the Rock Bottom Remainders were going to play a show. And that was the rock band that Stephen King was in with Dave Barry and Amy Tan and Mitch Albom and a bunch of folks. And I have to call out Kathy Kamen Goldmark, who organized the Rock Bottom Remainders, who passed away. But in any case, I ran into Dave Barry in the cafeteria. And of course, I wanted to get a book to Stephen King. My first novel, The Between, had already come out. And let's just say when I emailed Dave about that directly, he shut it down pretty quickly because I'm sure everybody was asking him that, like how annoying that everybody wants your friend to read their book. So I had backed away. But when I saw him in the cafeteria, I just had to gush about how, oh, I play keyboard, I said, and I do. And oh my gosh, I've always dreamed of being like, I don't know, in the spring training group for the Rock Bottom Remainders. It's just babbling, honestly. And he said, well, Mitch Albom is going to be doing vocals for the Elvis number. Do you know how to play Jailhouse Rock? I did not know how to play Jailhouse Rock. But I say, yeah, I know how to play
That's the
Jailhouse Rock.
move. Of course I can.
I'll tell you one thing, I'm going to learn how to play it before the show. So that's how I ended up on a stage. I mean, it's just so surreal with my pleather short shorts and fishnets, because that's how the women dressed. Okay. And I later learned that the roadies turned my volume way down because I didn't know how it was going to sound. But let's face it, it's three chords, right? It's like most rock, it's three chords. I figured out the three chords and I gave Stephen King a copy of The Between. So this was, and I signed it to him so he couldn't just hand it back to me. No, so not that he would have. So when it was time to try to get blurbs for my second novel, My Soul to Keep, and back in those days, he had his address in the Horror Writers Association book. Everybody knew how to mail something to Stephen King. And I asked him if he would, read My Soul to Keep, and we waited for a response. One day I came home and there was a letter in my mailbox from Bangor, Maine, and I held it up to the light. I could see it was like literally three lines. So I was like, oh crap, because that usually that looks like a rejection.
Cease and desist.
But I opened it And it said, "Dear Tanana Reeve, if I may, I really enjoyed The Between, and I would be happy to read My Soul to Keep, Steve King." And I let out such a shriek that I'm sure my neighbors heard it. And it's and he faxed it in the day it was due, like literally the day it was due, he faxed it in.
Wow.
That's nice. I love that. That's a good. How was it performing?
I mean, oh, that was nerve-wracking. You know, Beyonce talks about how she has to have an alter ego to get up on that stage, and I totally can relate to that because it was like an out-of-body experience just to be in the presence of not just King, but Aimee Tan and all these amazing writers at the same time, and feeling very insecure about my musical skills. So I really had to channel a whole different kind of side of my personality just not to be overcome with imposter syndrome.
Mike Flanagan's The Life of Chuck opens in select theaters June 6th and everywhere June 13th, and I'm going to keep bugging you all about it until you see it, and then I'm going to insist you go again and bring two friends along. Need I remind you that on top of Tom Hiddleston, Mark Hamill, Chiwetel Ejiofor, Matthew Lillard, the great Mia Sara, and Jacob Tremblay, that you get appearances by me and the late great Scott Wampler. Critics everywhere are praising the film, which won the Audience Award at the Toronto International Film Festival, and reading between the lines, I fully believe that it was me and Scott providing our cameos that pushed this one over the line. I mean, nobody outright says this, but is it coincidence that Mike's first Stephen King movie to win a major audience award at a gigantic international film festival happens to be the first movie that features the KingCast's OG hosts? I think not. I apologize to Tom Hiddleston and Karen Gillan for stealing their spotlight, but that's just what happens when Scott and I lend our angelic voices and our Adonis-like physiques to a production such as this. I hope they understand, and I wish them better luck on their next projects. Once again, The Life of Chuck opens in select theaters June 6th and everywhere June 13th. Go see it. You'll love it. Now back to the show.
Well, you've touched on it a little bit, you know, how far back you go as a reader. So this might be a good spot to give us your Stephen King origin story. Like this, you know, I'm very curious what the thing was that kind of got you to notice King in the first place.
Well, I know this story very well. And it's also a shout out to my late mother, Patricia Stevens Dew. I mean, not to get heavy with it, but my mother was a civil rights activist who basically bore scars from the civil rights movement because she had to wear dark glasses after being tear gassed when she was a college student at Florida A&M University. And she was very, very serious-minded, always going to meetings, always ready to protest, but she loved horror movies and she loved horror. And I used to think that was a bug, but now I think it was a feature because I better understand the relationship between horror and trauma and how many people who love horror are coming out of trauma. Like Brian Fuller directed Queer for Fear, a documentary, and a lot of queer artists, and we're talking about that relationship. You know, you're outsiders, and you can relate to the monster. So all that stuff, I think my mom was really gravitating toward. Like if I watched The Mole People with her, now as an adult, I realize I was rooting for the mole people. They were being enslaved. They were being whipped. You know, I was seeing it as enslavement, and I wanted them to fight back. So it's not a surprise in that context that my mother was the one who gave me my first Stephen King novel, which was the shiny silver paperback version.
Okay. With Danny's, was that Danny's face that's
Yeah,
on it?
Yes, a little
yeah. The little
face.
blank face, because
Yeah.
he was born with the caul that they say. He didn't have a face when he was born.
And wow, you all remember details I've forgotten, but it's been a while since actually it's been a while since I've read that one. But I remember one of the things that jumped out at me about The Shining was a reference to the TV show Emergency, which was like my jam. I love that show. So the fact that I'm reading this book that was scaring the heck out of me, and all of a sudden there was a reference to Emergency, and I think a fire hose either jumping from the wall or Danny was imagining a fire hose jumping from the wall, it felt like the book had just grabbed me by the throat. And I had a similar experience with the film adaptation, which I don't know if you guys remember this, but unfortunately, you know, Mr. Halloran is basically sort of unceremoniously disposed of in the movie as opposed to the book, kind of as a sacrifice, really. But in the scene where Scatman Crothers is on vacation and he's living his best life. And the news story comes on. It was Glenn Ranker from WPLG in Miami. That was my local
Oh,
anchor.
wow.
So
Oh,
for a
right.
kid sitting in a theater to see an adaptation of a book that's already scared you to death, to have that really feel like the news had broken into the movie theater, I had such cognitive dissonance. I thought it was a real news report. I was so confused. And then it turned out it was just like some background for the movie, but it like scared the crap out of me. Again, it was like it reached out and grabbed me by the throat. So The Shining was my first Stephen King.
Where did you go from
Brutal.
there? Did you just keep reading his stuff, or did it take you a while to get back into him? And
Oh no, man, I don't remember the order, but I probably tore through everything I could find. Carrie, I remember very specifically that when I was reading The Stand, I was sick. So that was like every page I had a symptom of Captain Trips, and I was, very worried about that. I can't describe it. It was just as if I had discovered like a perfect mode of storytelling I hadn't even known I was missing. It was just that horror, especially literary horror, touched me in a very, very deep way.
How old were you when you were doing this? Because I was in sixth grade when I read my first Stephen King, and some, doing the show and asking this question to so many people, it's so you're checking off a lot of boxes for this one. It's like you remember the artwork of the book that was handed to you. It in for a lot of people, I'd say easily 70% of the people we ask this question to, it's their mothers that turned them on to King.
Isn't
It's
that interesting?
not, sometimes it's an older sibling. Mostly it's the mom, and I think Kate Siegel's the only one I can think of that had her dad was the one that was super into Stephen King. But it's so great, 'cause that's how, my mother was a big Stephen King reader, and I remember pulling this her ratty, dust jacket falling off copy of The Stand off of the shelf, and I think it was her paperback of Cujo that I took to school one day, and I'm like, I'm just gonna read this. And that's when I was, in sixth grade. But
I was a
it's
bit older.
yeah.
We don't need to get into numbers,
Who's counting?
Numbers are just a concept. But I would say it was probably more middle school, high school. I think the version of Carrie I read was the movie tie-in, so it has Sissy Spacek's blood-drenched body on the cover. It's what I'm remembering. Holy cow! But yeah, and through young adulthood, I was literally at work at the Miami Herald when I finished reading Dead Zone. And I had gone straight from Cujo to the Dead Zone, so I didn't give myself time to grieve after Cujo, because we know that if you read the book, you know that it does not go well for the little boy. And I didn't let myself grieve. I went right to the Dead Zone, and then when I got to the end of the Dead Zone, the grief just caught up with me, and I remember just sobbing in the bathroom at my workplace at the Miami Herald.
Wow.
That
And
is
that's
just.
a good book that has crossover too, because Bannerman is killed by Cujo, but he's the sheriff in Dead Zone.
Oh, great. I didn't even notice that.
When
Yeah.
I and Todd, the that's his name, right? The
The
guy that's
serial
the serial
killer.
killer, something Todd, I think. But he's like, there's like a whole theory that Cujo wasn't just rabid, he was also possessed by the ghost of the Castle Rock Strangler and all that, because he was like
Well, that
in
would
dad's
make
closet
sense.
and all that stuff.
That would totally make sense. And of course, when it came to You Like It Darker, one of my favorite stories in there was the continuation of Cujo. I think
Rattlesnakes.
that was Rattlesnakes. That's probably my favorite story. Yeah.
It was very cool. So
So
you, oh, go ahead.
go ahead, Eric. No,
I
take it
think
away.
we're probably about to do the same thing, and that's transition over to the Talk of the
I was
Outsider.
just gonna say, let's do it together. Go
So
ahead
the
after me.
Outsider. I'm a big fan of this book. I'm a big fan of the adaptation on HBO. I think it got a lot right, and I think some of the changes were even better than the things that King would do, specifically when it comes to the character of Ralph, the kind of cynical detective. Like in the show, they have his son is dead, and that's the reason why he's got such a I don't know. I was trying to come up with a much better term, a much more eloquent term than hate boner, but he has a hate boner for poor Terry Maitland. But I think it really kind of underlines the character a little bit more and puts him into sharper focus, where he has a personal connection to what's going on versus I'm just angry that a kid, is dead, which should be justification enough, but I do like that extra step. So, Tanana Reeve, why did this one jump out to you as a book you wanted to cover?
This one is really special for me. This is from the King, what I call the 2.0 period, although really if we were counting, it would be a lot higher than 2.0.
Right.
But many years ago, some of you may remember, Stephen King announced he was retiring. I don't know if he was telling himself he was retiring or who, but I mean, clearly he did not retire. But for me as a reader, I kind of took that as a sign. I was like, oh, he's retiring, so I'm just gonna take a break for a while, and I noticed I never read Cell. Like, there's some books I missed. I missed quite a few books. I always jumped at his short story collections. I love his short stories, but I wasn't reading his novels for a while. I want to say maybe 10 years. And then for some reason, The Outsider came to my attention. And I was like, okay, well, clearly King did not retire. He's probably written 10 books since he said he retired.
Yeah, he's put
And
out
you need
more
to
work
pick.
since he retired than most people put out in
It's
their
quite a
entire
retirement,
life. Yeah.
yeah.
So let me, like, where do I jump back on this train, basically? And I had written a detective series, like a mystery series with my husband called Tennyson Hardwick series, where I read a lot of Michael Connelly and became a really big Michael Connelly fan. So when I saw that Michael Connelly had blurbed The Outsider, unless I'm mistaken about this, I remember a blurb, or at least King and Connelly had a friendship of some kind that informed this genre I didn't even know I needed yet again, which was the paranormal procedural. Like, procedurals in and of themselves, I've seen a million of them. At this point, it's really hard to catch my attention with a procedural. But if you add a supernatural element, I am all over it. Because as we all know, especially in horror movies, let's say, police are useless in horror for this exact same reasons that this detective is useless in The Outsider for a lot of some of it. Some of it, okay? It's just they're not willing to believe. You're wasting your breath to try to talk about anything paranormal or supernatural with the police. And this book, wow, this book just really grabbed me. I tried to start rereading it just for like to refresh myself for this podcast, and I couldn't do it because that opening arrest at the baseball park is so tragic to me. What happens to Terry Maitland? I'm literally haunted by what happened to Terry in this story. And the miniseries recreated it so beautifully, except you can see how over the top it is to do it while the stadium is like full. The whole town is there, that
The
march of
humiliation of
shame.
it, yeah.
Yeah, the humiliation. I mean, of course you're going to incite violence with such an ostentatious arrest in such a tiny town. So he bears a lot of responsibility for what happened to Terry, just from the nature of that very public gotcha, you monster arrest. And who's better to play him, right? In the miniseries than, oh my gosh, why am I forgetting his
Jason
name?
Bateman.
I love
Jason
this.
Bateman.
Thank you,
Yeah, just
Jason
the aw
Bateman. Love
shucks
Jason
Arrested
Bateman.
Development guy. Yeah.
Who also directed
Yes.
those episodes? Didn't he direct the first
He
two
did. Yes.
episodes?
Yeah.
So well done. I'm so glad he came on to the project. He's the perfect face of Terry. And yeah, it's a tragedy. It's such a tragic story. But what I love about it, and what I love in all, like, let's talk about even just the miniseries version. My favorite moment in horror is when the characters all come together and they're like, oh, well, I did hear a strange sound out in the shed the other night, but I just thought it was the dog. And then she's like, no, I heard that sound too. It's like when everybody sort of comes together and shares their stories and they come up with a plan. That is my favorite moment because I think that so closely mirrors to me like all the incidents, like even in the civil rights era when my parents would have meetings and decide, okay, here's this big problem. What are we going to do about it? It kind of mirrors a big step we all have to take in life, even if it's not about the supernatural. So watching Ralph and this actor, oh, just captured Ralph so well. The moment that realization tugs at him when he has to accept that this is beyond his understanding. It is beyond human physics, human capacity, that he is facing the unknown. I love it so much. It's like a war on his face. And he finally gives this little nod to Cynthia Erivo, who's playing Holly. He's like, okay, I get it. Or his wife. I forget like when that exact moment happens. It could be his wife who finally convinced him, but let's get serious now. Let's get on the same page and let's fight this thing. Oh, that's what I love.
Ben, I love that phrase, war. There was like a war on his face. That's really what happens. You're talking about Ben Mendelsohn's character,
Yes, Ben Mendelsohn, yes.
Did such a spectacular job because it's the crumbling of his certainty, right? Because it's like he didn't just arrest this guy on a hunch. He brought him down in front of the whole town because he was certain. Here are your fingerprints. We have your DNA. We have eyewitnesses who spotted you, who know who you are and saw you with blood on your face. We have video surveillance footage of you. Like, there's no question in his mind when he arrests him. And it's only after it's too late to change anything. Once he's, I think we can say a little spoiler alert here, like Terry Maitland gets killed, like before he can even be put on trial, like the first third of the book. Then it's like, okay, then the confidence begins to crumble. Then it's like, well, there's this other footage of Terry Maitland, over in Ohio at this book fair. And I think there's a scene, I'm not sure if this is the one you talk about, like Cynthia Erivo's Holly is the one who convinces him, no, there's something else. There's something weird happening here, something weird in the neighborhood. And like, but there's a scene Ben has with his wife where she goes, what do you think happened once all this conflicting information comes up? And he just, again, that war plays out on his face and he's like, I don't know. Like, I don't know. And this is a character whose business is knowing, solving the crime, solving the case, being a detective. And he's detected all of the correct information, but he still doesn't know. What a terrifying state of flux that is to be unknown, right? Like, I don't know how to make sense of this. And then the only other solution is it doesn't make sense. It's beyond our knowing. It's supernatural. Like, what a great twist.
Well, as we're talking about it, I just want to watch it all over again. It's just so well done and captures the book so well. And in the miniseries version, it's even more obvious that Terry couldn't have been in two places at once. Right? I mean, I think because we're seeing the foot, like we see him at the conference asking a question, standing up. I mean, it's clearly him. How do you, and I was so mad at Ralph for not putting that together faster.
What's also really interesting about this section is that you, the reader, you're like, you're kind of like at the beginning, you're just like, no, fuck this guy. Of course, he was seen. He has, there's no other way his DNA and his fingerprints would be all over this stuff. King takes it. The inciting incident is extremely horrific. It's,
Vile.
abuse and the torture, rape, killing of a child. And like, just the thing that, like, just automatically you hear that and you just go, fuck those, whatever, just burn them
It's
at the stake.
infuriating. It's so ugly that it's angry making,
And so
right?
he puts you in the perspective of like, okay, at the beginning you're with Ralph, you're like, bring this guy down. I want the whole community to see it. And once you start being presented by evidence as a reader, you turn around much quicker than Ralph does, obviously. But
Well, you know you're in a story, right? Who doesn't?
I still had that doubt, like, in that first quarter of the book where I'm just like, all right, he has these alibis, but I didn't know what the story was. I read it right when it came out, so I didn't know that, like, oh, that's it's it's I think it's pretty well known now, so it's a doppelganger story, but at that when
Shapeshifter.
you're a shapeshifter, and when you're like looking at it fresh, though, you're kind of with it, and I assume that that's what a lot of people watching it on HBO probably felt if they didn't know the story, that you're sitting there going, like, could this guy be pulling a fast one on this? Is this like he an alibi that he's setting up to get away with this murder? And you could absolutely, see Stephen King writing something like that too. I was kind of with the people. I love it when King can, or any author, but King in particular, can take, your allegiances and shift them within a story. You know what I mean?
I was Team Terry pretty much as quickly as one could be Team Terry, like the
No
minute, because
doubt
you
in your mind.
said, like Anthony said, I mean, we know we're in a Stephen King novel, so we
Run.
know it's the uncanny, and I'm like, something happened here.
Okay. No.
Poor Terry,
Yeah.
especially when he became, Jason Bateman. Poor Terry,
Right.
but. Yeah, I mean, just hanging on every detail. Like I remember the gift shop and going to the gift shop
The
to see if his
fingerprint.
fingerprints were on the book. And it's like, oh gosh, just like I said, it's a tragedy. And what's interesting is that King weaves tragedy within tragedy when you bring in the whole cave segment of the story because of the history of what happened, which again is so visceral when you watch it. I think it's the same as in the novel, but this areas of these caverns where two brothers got lost and their voices bouncing around. So even though people knew they were lost, they still couldn't find where they were. So not only did the boys die, but the search party dies. It's like, holy cow, talk about the saddest place. Like, of course, the spirit would gravitate to such a sad, tragic place. All the
Cursed place,
tears
yeah.
that have watered this spot, and this is where the showdown is going to take place. So yeah, I love, 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 love The Outsider. And of course, I had to go right down the rabbit hole with the rest of the Mr. Mercedes and the Holly Gibney. I mean, that The Outsider was my entree to that
The
whole
Holly, yeah.
vein of King's writing.
Tell me, as a storyteller yourself, the device of killing Terry off, I think, is a really surprising one, because I think another author might have said, this will be the engine of the story, is proving the innocent man, proving this accused man to be innocent, and that he would stay in prison while they tried to track down the outsider and then eventually freed him. But the cons King kills him off. Like, there's no justice for Terry. You can't fix it. You can't right this wrong. What does that do to the story?
Not
That's
just in death, by the way. It's his reputation, his family is re like, no
oh,
matter what, for the rest of like that generation, he is known as the child killer. No,
yeah.
even no matter they could come out and say, nope, it wasn't him. It doesn't matter. Once that cork is popped, it's
Yeah, and the fractured relationship between the two wives, Terry's widow and Ralph's wife. But I don't obviously know this, but I would imagine if I were King, because I talked about how you want to mix it up when you have a lot of books and you've done a lot of things. He probably didn't want to repeat that Green Mile beat, which delays, the death longer. But it is still very much a story that feels like, at least in the novel version, it's about trying to prove this guy's innocence. And one of my husband, Stephen Barnes's pet peeves in The Green Mile is that in the novel, the warden does try to help Coffee,
John Coffey, yeah.
He tries to help him. Whereas in the movie version, it's just, all the mouse tricks, but we never actually get around to giving a damn about him as a human being. But I digress. I think maybe I don't know if he was trying to not repeat that beat where that seemed to be so much of the engine of that book was is proving his innocence and justice for Coffee rather. Instead, it's more about how did I get this so wrong? How did I get this so wrong, and how can I keep this from happening again?
Right. I think it's also, I mean, and you guys are experts on The Stand, but he pulls a similar beat in The Stand where Nick Andros gets blown up, and the guy that's being set up, when you're reading through that book, it's so clear he's being set up as the protagonist. Like, not Stu Redman. Like, Stu's around, Stu's the nice guy, but like, Nick is set up to be the one, right?
See, and now you're reminding me. I cried and cried and cried when I thought Stu had died, right? Oh, I cried in the middle of the book.
Yep. And it what's and I think King has been interviewed about that and was saying he essentially got stuck at that part and he didn't know what to do. And I believe he had read somewhere, he had this some so, he had heard some author like suggest if you're ever stuck, blow shit up or something, and like blow something up. And he's like, he literally put a bomb in there, and when it took Nick, he the way King writes, he didn't know it was gonna happen, until he's there, and he's like, no, it just makes sense. And so all the buildup he's done, and you've lost, this guy, and he's like, but it suddenly opened up the possibilities to be, endless from that point on. It's like now that the bomb has gone off in Boulder, Colorado. It's like now what happens, and that gave him all the freedom to continue on. So I wonder if part of that played into it, or it was just the byproduct of this is how I establish the outsider feeds on grief and the perpetual cycle of one act and how that can just destroy not just a family of the murdered kid. It destroys, the family of the accused. It destroys the extended family. It destroys the family of the people who did the accusing.
Yeah, it's the collateral damage
It's the
outside of
collateral
the initial
damage.
act.
And
Yeah.
so what you don't without Terry Maitland, getting got, in the first quarter of the book, or the first third, I guess, of the book, then the whole, grief demon aspect of the outsider, I guess, doesn't clock, right? So
And I think grief is such a great carrier tone in
yeah.
horror. My
Oh, yeah.
theory about why so much horror opens with grief. Not even so much this, although it does if you care about Terry at the time he dies, which a lot of people don't. Until later. But I think it's because grief is the first horror we experience. And no matter how old we are, when we experience grief, it's very, very difficult to get our minds around the notion that someone was here and now they're gone. And beyond that, that sort of yawning unknown that is our own mortality, because that's just further proof every time, whether we believe it or not, and deep down we really don't believe it, but whether we believe it or not, our turn is coming too. And if you look at like Hereditary, Midsommar, Jordan Peele's Nope, I mean, you could go on and on and on with horror movies that literally open with someone dying and the impact of that death on the people around them as the doorway that opens up the horror. So a grief monster, a grief shapeshifter is a perfect monster, really, for a horror novel. And without Terry's death doesn't feel so tragic at the moment it happens, but the tragedy grows as you proceed into the book. And it's that feeling of, Ralph, like, I messed up. I messed this up. And now a good man is dead. That's a hard thing to let in for anyone, especially a detective who has that kind of a gift for his job, like how did you get this so badly wrong?
It's grief compound. You're right, that is a great vehicle for horror. I think Pet Cemetery is so powerful
Oh,
because
God.
it's so sad, like it breaks your
Yes.
heart, and you do this too in your work in the reformatory. It breaks your heart, and I think that you're right, that's where the that's where the scares creep in, is into the fissures that the grief
Yeah.
hits you with. But
Revival's another great Stephen King story driven by grief.
Grief coupled with regret too, this crushing regret that just grows stronger and stronger as it continues. And then the family, the family of the victim, they all get swept away and consumed by the outsider as well. And that part reminded me of Salem's Lot. You remember the two little boys, the one who comes to the window, floating in the window, and like his
How would I
mother.
forget that?
Who can forget? No one can forget that. But their mother gets taken, and remember she comes alive in the morgue, and that's where they first realize they have that meeting you talked about tonight, Areve, where they're like, oh, something is going on here. And then let's watch her body. And she comes back, wakes up and is a vampire. And that family disappearing reminded me of Salem's Lot, how they just took one right after another. The whole family is gone. Everybody's gone. And then there's no coming back.
And it's just real, I believe all of it. I believe the anger, the rage of the assassination of Terry, and how, I feel so much for victims of violence in that way, because it's bad enough to lose someone, but to lose someone to violence is almost unfathomable in that way.
We should shout out Richard Price, who's also a acclaimed novelist, one of my favorite writers, who did the screen, who wrote the screenplay, wrote the episodes for The Outsider. It's like a cool combination of authors there.
Put his foot in that. Just every single episode is chef's kiss. Just absolutely astounding. And, you know, Holly has had a couple of different incarnations and they're both very good, but Cynthia Erivo, I have to say, did such a good job as Holly. Yeah. She's the Holly I see in my head.
Yeah. It's hard for me to refocus my Holly when I'm reading after seeing The Outsider. Cause I agree. Like that's my instinct now is to think of Cynthia Erivo in the role, you know, and I sometimes I'm not very successful with it. I think I still reading Holly. I was, which is odd, but I was fluctuating back and forth between the two actresses that have played her.
Justine Loop is the other actress. Yeah. She's really good though. She does the narration for some of the books too.
She does. Yeah.
No, she is.
Yeah.
No shade to anybody. I mean, everybody's good. It's just.
I think that what Cynthia did is she embraced Holly's weirdness in a way that is. It's starkly different, but it's in the same wavelength as the previous version, but it's like of the character in the Mr. Mercedes TV show. But there's just something about, you know, the way that Cynthia Erivo just makes a meal out of everything she, you know, does, even in a subtle way. It's just the way that Holly's always like looking, you know, in different directions. She, you know what I mean? It's like there's something about it that just is a little bit more like, I don't know, iconic about it. I don't know if that's the right
iconic word. Is the perfect word for that entire show, by the way.
Yeah.
I mean, really, Holly. The story is iconic even before it was a limited series, but the limited series is also iconic. Those moments, the baseball diamond, the assassination, the cave, the meeting, you know, all the moments to be just jump out.
I love the way Cynthia Erivo captures like the way Holly, and this is, I guess you've already sort of characterized it, Eric, but her Holly is always calling in from a distant planet. You know,
yes.
Like, she's not really there, or you're not really there, or somebody's not really there. Isn't there, I'm seeming, it's been a while since I've seen the series, but I feel like there's a, like our introduction to her, she's sitting at a bar, like some hotel bar somewhere, going over some figures or going over the facts of the case and like talking, and the bartender is just like, why are you telling me this? It's like that it's like that equivalent of, this is an Arby's, sir, like after a long rant. Like she's just calling in with this information and processing it, and the real world is not as real to Holly as it is to everybody else, and
that
enables her to see the sort of weirder edges.
Well, that's it. She's an outsider too, of her own of her own way. I mean, that's the thing. And
absolutely, and
you need somebody like Holly who's willing to look beyond just the normal, this is how things run thing. And I think that's why I love Cynthia in this role so much, is because she brings that outsider presence to the character. She gets to be the good version of the outsider, you know, somebody that doesn't belong, you know, but and knows that and is maybe a little sad about it, but also knows that that's also kind of her superpower too, and knows she can help people with her unique point of view. So I think that if people, I know that some folks, like, they either love Holly Gibney as a character or they're tired of her, that are like constant readers. I'm definitely of the, I love Holly, and you can give me a thousand books of hers if you want. But I think The Outsider is the one that, like, at least for me, like, really made the character lock into place when I was reading. Like, I liked her in the Mr. Mercedes books and just fine, but you know, the later Mr. Mercedes books weren't my favorite. And that's the one where she gets more, you know, center focus. But I think that, like, The Outsider's where, to me, it's just like, kabam, that's the character locked in that you know, I'll follow her to, you know, her own book where she's fighting elderly cannibals or whatever.
You know? That was a good one.
You can take shout me wherever out. You want.
Shout out to Holly for getting her little love story.
Yes.
Beat too in The Outsider. I mean, for someone like her who must have such trouble with connection, that even knowing how it goes It's such a breath of fresh air just to see that connection and that caring, like someone who's not accustomed to it, to just sort of release themselves to, oh, kind of like Jeff Goldblum and Gina Davis in The Fly when he says to her, is this a relationship we're having? Is that what this is? It's just like that awkwardness that, but I'm going to lean in even though I don't understand it. I just love that.
Well, I think this is a good place to wrap up, right?
Yeah, I think we're getting to, we've held Tananarive Due in thrall with Stephen King bullshittery for too long, I think.
I have one last Stephen King note, if you
All
have
right.
time.
Please.
Sure.
Please.
One of my proudest moments is one that maybe not a lot of people know about, but we did an event called Scare Up the Vote back in October,
Right.
which was the horror community coming together in a huge community Zoom call with, I mean, basically everybody I asked, whether it was Stephen Graham Jones, Paul Tremblay. My proudest moment of that was that Joe Hill and Stephen King did a segment together, which is something I had never seen before. I'm
No.
not saying
I
it's never
watched.
happened.
I watched. I was watching.
Great. But, and of course, now it's more than bittersweet because I can't even look back at it yet one day. But it's more than bittersweet because we were all talking about a series of horrible events that have all come to pass, that and worse, frankly. But in that moment of hopefulness, when we didn't realize that one of the biggest Google searches on election day would be, is Joe Biden running for president? And we thought we could actually move the needle to have the entire community just come together, put themselves out there, and just celebrate ourselves as a horror community and a caring horror community. I just, that's probably my favorite Stephen King moment, to be honest, watching him and Joe Hill being a father and son and just chatting it up and talking about their favorite horror and also why we needed to try to save democracy.
That was good. I remember you sharing the clip too on your social media too. But that that's almost the equivalent of what you described earlier in the show, Tananarive. The that that's like the group getting together, right?
Yes, having a meeting.
Having a meeting and say, well, what is the worst case scenario here? What can
What's
we
the
do to solve
plan?
it? What's the plan?
What's the plan? And you know, it's not over. It's not over. I don't think Scare Up the Vote will be completely dead. But you know, it didn't go as we hoped the first time. But when I look back on those comments, I don't know if it's overrun with trolls by now, but when I look back at the comments from the day of the event, people all over the country that maybe they lived in a red state and they felt isolated just could feel like they were in an actual community. And that is very meaningful.
It's the equivalent of I guess it was sort of established by Bram Stoker when Van Helsing gets those guys together and says, "Here's what we're gonna do," you know? And I we've got enough real life horrors out there in the world, but if the supernatural ever does come my way, Tananarive, you're my Van Helsing. I think you know all the monsters, you know all the tropes, you know all the places not to go. I'm
yeah.
to you. For guidance in battling the supernatural, because
Yeah, I'm bringing my
you've studied
apocalyptic RV van to you guys.
One free hint, gentlemen, if you're running from a monster in the darkened woods, get off the road. There's a path through the woods. Don't be on that path because that's the most obvious place to find you. You get off of the side. You can hide. Literally, you can hide in the woods. The woods are big. So that's my hint. Get off the
But
road.
then we end up in a girl who loved Tom Gordon situation, and
Lost in
we're
the
gonna get
woods.
and we're gonna
Cross
trip out
that
on some
bridge. Cross that
Better to
bridge
be
when you get to
lost
it.
than hunted.
That's true. Well,
Yeah,
Tananarive, I'm so glad that you came on the show, and it's a pleasure, you know, talking with you in depth for the first time,
Thank
and
you.
you're welcome back at any point. So next time you got a book out and you wanna publicize it, you know, we got a good 60 plus other Stephen King titles that we can talk to you about.
You
So,
better believe it. I've had a blast and I can't wait to come back.
Tananarive, tell our listeners where can they find you? Where are the best places to keep up with you?
I am on Blue Sky and I mean, for now, Instagram and Threads always under my name at Tanana Reeve Du. And Steve and I also started our own little social media group for people who are writers who just want to build better lives, called Life Write on Circle, and it's at lifewrite.com.
Well, thank you again for being here. Best to Stephen. Maybe you two could come on together next time.
That would be fun.
Many thanks to Tanana Reeve Du for joining us on this episode. It was a delight finally getting to speak with her, and I hope she comes back for more in the future. Now, at the end of the last episode, I promised a Life of Chuck guest in an upcoming episode, and I'm happy to say it looks like that's exactly what we're going to get. Someone associated with that film will, in fact, be the KingCast's next guest. Who will it be? Well, you have about 95 potential suspects to choose from that production. Loaded cast and crew there. The only hint I'll give is that the next guest is someone that hasn't been on the KingCast before, so let the speculation begin. I'll also remind you that the very best way to support the show directly is to sign up for our Patreon over at patreon.com/thekingcast. There's a backlog of hundreds of hours of bonus episodes, a rowdy Discord, and brand new bonus episodes dropped on the regular. We have one coming up where Bresnikan and I dive into The Long Walk a bit. We talk about his reveal story, his first look story at Vanity Fair, how that came together. And we kind of dig deep into what Francis Lawrence's film could be. I somehow managed to get on my soapbox about how much I love The Last of Us in that episode. But that's the kind of quality stuff you can get over at our Patreon. So once again, patreon.com/thekingcast. Throw us a few bucks a month and we will make it worth your while. Anyway, until next time, adios, folks. The KingCast is hosted by Eric Vespi, that's me, and Anthony Bresnikan. The show is produced by myself as well as Abby Goel and Tara Ansley, and is distributed by the Fangoria Podcast Network. Daniel Danger is our art director, and the show was created by me, the late, great Scott Wampler.